I guess I wanted to start by saying that, like, a lot of the time, the sort of mainstream theories and explanations of fascism, the ones that you're likely to encounter in, like, you know, classes or, in, like, mainstream political discussion at universities, I think they often end up, I reckon, mystifying the real roots of fascism. They're usually presented as like some sort of alien force to mainstream politics, or often they explain fascism just purely in terms of ideas and cultural prejudices of like various national groups. So like, you know, just as a couple of examples of this, one of the more notorious sort of mainstream ideas comes from Daniel Goldhagen in his book Hitler's Willing Executioners, where he basically argued that German fascism was deeply ingrained in the culture and psyche of every single individual German. There was part of the German culture for all time and forever. So in this sense, fascism in was specific to Germany and specific to their own cultural prejudices that existed there. Other examples are like in academia, it's very common to just look at fascism as purely a set of ideas, just what the fascists say about themselves a lot of the time. So if people might have read Dave Renton's book, he talks about this at length, about the new consensus school in academia, where they say fascism is just a set of ideas, and if you adopt all of these ideas together, you're a fascist. And some of the things they say are like, you know, if you are both anti-capitalist and anti-conservative, that is like a qualifier for being a fascist. So one of the problems is with both of these theories is that they kind of fail to really, I think, get to the root of why fascist organizations are able to grow at particular periods versus others. So if German fascism is just a permanent reality of German people, why do the fascists grow in the 30s and not just any time? Why isn't there a constant state of fascism and anti-Semitism, I mean, like extreme violent anti-Semitism all the time in Germany? Similarly, like, I think one of the problems of seeing fascism just as a set of ideas and propaganda and looking at like the fascist propaganda, to figure out what these ideas are is that the fascists changed a lot of their propaganda very quickly and very often. So, you know, the thing about like one of the new consensus school arguments is that fascism is characterized by both anti-capitalist and anti-conservative and anti-right-wing ideas. So then kind of neither left nor right or whatever, in a sense. One of the problems about this is that pretty much all of the both fascists in Italy and Germany did at the early stages have kind of like anti-rich rhetoric at the start, but they dropped all of that as soon as they got to power. So just seeing fascism in terms of like the ideas that it expresses at the start of its, birth, I guess, doesn't really help you understand how fascism developed and grew and what it was actually likely to do when it got closer to power. So I think you need to go beyond just a set of ideas and beyond just a conception that there's like a culture inherent in all of us that, means that we could, inevitably going to support, a fascist dictatorship. So I think instead, I think a Marxist analysis is really needed to actually fully understand fascism in the 1930s, in its classical period. And to do this, Marxists see fascism first and foremost in the context of the deep crises that existed all throughout capitalism after World War I. And I think, the crisis of capitalism is an important backdrop because it allows you to explain why, every step of the way, the degeneration and violence of the capitalist system, opened up more space for fascist politics and organization and helped them, grow at particular times in this period of crisis. I'm going to mostly talk about fascist movements in Italy and Germany, which were probably the two most developed and successful fascist movements in the 30s or in the 20s and 30s. And they were different. They were different from previous forms of right-wing politics in that they weren't organized primarily through the military or sections of the mainstream capitalist elite. But there was a central similarity between them, which was that they were for reaction, they were hostile to the workers' movement, and for the capitalist system ultimately, no matter what their initial rhetoric said. So Marxists argued at the time that the fascist movements in the classical period, in the interwar period, expressed the anger of the middle classes who had suffered in economic crises, and they organised this anger into mass political organisations aimed at crushing the workers' movement and the left. Every attempt to preserve capitalist rule, like normal capitalist rule in this period, ultimately ended up emboldening and normalising a lot of the politics of the fascists. And they ultimately came to power with the support of, you know, heads of industry and the capitalist elite and the conservative elite. These forces allowed fascists to come to power because they thought only the fascists were able to stabilise the capitalist system and crush the oppositional socialist and working class movements that existed in each country. The period where this whole period, basically, it shows how barbaric the system of capitalism is prepared to become when it's threatened and when, you know, its stability is interrupted and disrupted by, you know, struggles from below. The Marxist account of fascism is, like, pretty contested, but I honestly think that it's the only way that we can really adequately account for what happened during this period of history. So first I want to talk about crisis and how that related to, like, growth of fascism. So after World War I and during the Great Depression, countries all throughout Europe experienced extreme crises that paralysed the capitalist economic and political system. This crisis provoked mass resistance and unrest from below. And the fascists grew primarily by orienting to social layers that wanted a return to order above anything else, and who were hostile to both the mainstream capitalist parties, the centre parties that had previously ruled the system, as well as the workers' movement. So, for example, in Italy was rocked by a series immediately after World War I, was rocked by a series of extremely militant mass working class strikes after the war. This paralysed the capitalist economy. In this context, Mussolini's fascist party grew on the basis of its squadristi terrorist campaigns, where fascist party organisations terrorised the left and the working class, first in the countryside and then in more developed cities. So they ransacked union buildings and offices of left-wing parties and newspaper production places for the left. They would attack left-wing meetings and demonstrations in order to disorganise working-class resistance. And they killed hundreds of workers and leftists through, you know, violent street, violent campaigns on the streets. This terror campaign was enthusiastically actually welcomed by the agricultural capitalists throughout Italy and farmers, who immediately began funding Mussolini's fascist party and the squadristi, because the fascists could accomplish what the police and the state couldn't. They ended up restoring order in the economy first in the rural areas and then in the cities. They restored order by breaking resistance and disorganising the militant workers' movement that existed. Thousands of frustrated young middle-class men, mostly farmers and returned soldiers, people who were hostile to the left and kind of obsessed with law and order, joined the squadristi or supported their campaigns. Similarly, the Nazis in Germany grew into a mass movement in the context of deep economic and political crisis in the late 20s. After a decade of intense class struggle, mass workers' struggles, a near revolution in Germany, Hitler organised, terror squads that were in many ways similar to the squadristi in Italy. And these terror squads, again, were used to attack demonstrations and meetings of the left. They were used to try and break strikes while building a mass movement and a mass following, which Hitler also utilised through electoral campaigns. Fascist movements emerged pretty much anywhere, actually, all throughout. I'm mostly talking about Italy and Germany, but pretty much every major capitalist country experienced some sort of a fascist organisation that grew in this period. There were several fascist or quasi-fascist organisations that operated in Australia in the interwar period. Many were directly inspired by Mussolini and Hitler. Some of these groups, there's a good article in the Marxist Left Review that I encourage people to read for some of this history. It's really hidden from, most mainstream histories of Australia. But there are groups like the League of National Security or the New Guard all throughout New South Wales. Often these organizations had tens of thousands of members at various points, and they organized in ways to, you know, prepare for military, paramilitary combat with the left. So one thing which is like written out of history is that there was basically a demonstration in 1934 of the League of National Security, where they set up barricades and prepared for street fights against workers. But because they thought there was going to be a workers' insurrection, but the workers' insurrection didn't end up happening, so they, you know, retreated. But these groups existed all throughout this period in Australia, and the exact same sort of people, you know, middle class, like more likely from privileged backgrounds, shop owners, people who wanted a return to law and order to continue, you know, capitalist trading. The same sort of people joined these groups as in Italy and in Germany. So the fascists, you know, they argued for a rebirth of the nation in crisis. Through extreme authoritarianism and dictatorship and violence against what were perceived as enemies of the nation. They also argued, you know, that militarism was good, that war was good, and state expansion was, you know, a positive good that, you know, the fascists would achieve if they, you know, got into power. The thing about nationalist rebirth centered around, you know, pre-existing nationalist tropes in each country. So in Germany, they utilized pre-existing anti-Semitic ideas that were promoted by, you know, mainstream capitalist media. And the, you know, like that was just the standard politics of the right in Germany at the time. They also, you know, talked about biological Germanism and Nordic mythology. Whereas in Italy, it was a little bit different because, you know, those weren't popular themes for right-wing politics in Italy. So the fascist mythos there was focused on a revival and rebirth of the Roman Empire and, like, Romanism. They fetishized, like, symbols of the Roman Empire. The fascists also used, in the early stage, as I mentioned, they used radical rhetoric that condemned both the left and the mainstream capitalist establishment. They said that a strong nation state was a force that could overcome class divisions. And in the context of severe crisis, these sorts of ideas could have appeal among layers of society, particularly, as I said, among middle classes and small capitalists, returned soldiers, as well as workers and some sections of unemployed people. These social layers were attracted to fascism and disproportionately joined fascist organisations because they were affected by the crisis and they were hostile to the political establishment that had created and ruled over the crisis. But at the same time, they were disconnected from and hostile to the workers' movement. So the businesses of small shop owners and rural farmers, you know, rural farmers' businesses were often disrupted by strikes and economic turmoil. And in the context of the economic crisis, these layers were also hostile to big businesses who outcompeted them and could, you know, get their way through the crisis a lot easier. Notably, like when we're talking about like who joined the fascist parties and why, notably sections of the working class that were organised in trade unions were overwhelmingly hostile to fascist politics. The authoritarianism, the focus on like strengthening the state and the rejection of class conflict in you know, favour of class collaboration and national unity. All this tended not to appeal to organised sections of the working class. These, you know, workers were trained in ideas like solidarity, collective struggle. They were hostile to the state institutions that regularly, you know, repressed their strikes and protests. I think this is worth mentioning because the cliche kind of mainstream understanding of fascism is that it relied on the support of like, you know, just ordinary people and it, you know, relied on the prejudices of like uneducated, you know, stereotypical poor people or whatever. But in fact, workers in pretty much every country were, especially when they were organized in organizations like trade unions or working class political parties, were pretty much consistently the most hostile section of society to fascism. The crisis meant that while workers were more likely to blame capitalism and the ruling classes for their misery, sections of the middle class could just as much blame workers and the left for their impoverishment. Fascists often tried to attract working class support by using radical rhetoric that condemned capitalism and big business. You know, an example of this is that, you know, a lot of the early fascist programs, like Mussolini's initial program, included things like the 8-hour day and universal suffrage. But they dropped all that rhetoric as soon as they came to power. The more and more closer they got to power, the more they dropped any of these sort of pretenses to radicalism or pro-worker or anti-capitalist sentiments. And they dropped these ideas because they realized that the only way they were going to be able to come to power was if they could forge alliances with the mainstream elites and ruling class conservative political parties. And they were able to gain this support when the political crisis was so extreme that the ruling class could see no other way to contain it except to give power to the fascists. The two most clearly fascist regimes, the one state power in Italy and Germany, were installed into government outside electoral periods. So neither party forced its way to power, and neither party were just, you know, elected as the into power. Mussolini was installed by the King of Italy as Prime Minister in 1922. In Germany, the Nazis had run in elections for a long time and gotten successful results. But Hitler became Chancellor by the appointment of the President Hindenburg, who, in the midst of a political crisis in the 30s, Hindenburg explicitly supported the Nazis on the basis that, you know, the mainstream parties were too delegitimized to rule. And it was a choice either between the Nazis or working class parties. And Hindenburg, as a, you know, disgusting arch, like, reactionary capitalist, said he was quite clear about supporting the Nazis and supporting Hitler coming to power on the basis that it would be the only way that they could prevent working class political parties from coming to power. In both cases, the political establishment welcomed the fascists because their preferred tools for governing were too ineffective, racked by crisis and loathed by large sections of the population. Whereas the fascists were able to demonstrate some degree of mass political support and organisation, either through their election campaigns like in Germany or by organising campaigns of mass political violence in Italy. And this indicated to the ruling class that the fascists could be a political force capable of crushing the workers' movement and stabilising the system. Okay, well, one of the things that set aside fascism from other, you know, forms of right-wing politics was that they had this mass movement and mass base of support. This meant a few things for the left. It meant that the fascists presented an immediate threat to the workers' movement even before they were capable of seizing power. You know, their membership was cohered around the question of violently attacking and destroying left-wing meetings and organisations. And this meant that, you know, they could have very, like, be involved in very violent forms of repression, even when the state, you know, wasn't involved in it. They didn't wait for, you know, the state and the government to, you know, green light their acts of violence. They went ahead with it anyway. And so it was an immediate threat to the workers' movement. The fact that there was this mass movement also meant that when fascists came to power, it meant that reaction could be much deeper as the fascist mass movements became incorporated into sections of the state or existed and operated alongside state institutions. It meant that reaction and violence against the left and the workers' movement could be deeper and more thoroughgoing than, you know, what dictatorships looked like in the past. And the other thing about the mass fascist, like rabid radical right-wing street movements, meant that at particular times, those mass movements could put pressure on fascists to be more violent against put pressure on governments to be more violent against the working class. But, you know, having said all this, there are a lot of, you know, there are some differences between fascist and traditional right-wing political parties. But the similarity was that in power, the fascists stabilized the capitalist system through brutal repression. They were ardently pro-capitalist and, you know, none of the fascist governments, all of them ruled in the end in the interests of the, large landowners, the industrialists, with whose support they required to continue to remain in government. If anything, they just organized an exceptionally violent version of capitalist rule that destroyed huge sections of the workers' movement and any sort of sense of dissent or resistance. Well, I just, in conclusion, because I think I'm almost going over time, I think it's important to emphasize you know, fascism as a particularly radical form of pro-capitalist reaction, I guess, and, you know, right-wing politics that aimed to build a mass movement that could restore stability to the capitalist system. I think, yeah, any attempt to understand capitalism outside of, like, these connections to the capitalist system and this pro-capitalist motive, I think is, really not going to get anywhere in understanding this history. One, I think, last lesson that I think is relevant is that, and I think is particularly relevant today as well, is that throughout the 20s and the 30s, every attempt to kind of stabilize the capitalist system ended up, you know, strengthening the fascists in the long run. So in Italy, the Social Democrats argued that, you know, we have to seek an alliance with the bourgeoisie to prevent the fascists from coming to power. This, and similarly in Germany, the Social Democrats, the German Social Democratic Party, argued, well, we should campaign for Hindenburg because at least he's not as bad as Hitler. But the problem with this is that they ended up campaigning for the very people and very capitalist elites that ended up giving power, handing power over to the fascists. So, you know, even though all the Social Democrats campaigned for Hindenburg in the presidential elections, Hindenburg hated the Social Democrats and was more than happy to give power to the Nazis to prevent any, you know, working class power in Germany. And additionally, this sort of backing of the mainstream capitalist status quo, I think, went further to delegitimizing parties of the left and of the workers' movement, because it said, we don't have an alternative program. We have the same program of, you know, mainstream capitalist status quo politics that has led to the crises that, you know, is causing people to reject, you know, the mainstream political parties. So they ended up backing the status quo that was immiserating the lives of millions of people, that had, you know, organized World War One. They backed the, you know, capitalist system that made profits, massive profits out of the Great Depression, while workers, you know, and you know, petty bourgeois were forced into, you know, abject poverty and you know, hunger, and you know, where their lives were totally destroyed. So I think backing the mainstream in this scenario was presented as a way for us to kind of return to you know, pre-fascist, pre-crisis form of liberal democracy, but it ended up discrediting the left because the status quo was something that people were already rejecting en masse. And it disorganized the left and the ability of the left to continually to continually organize to fight against capitalism and pose as an alternative to the status quo rather than the people who just ended up defending it. And I think, you know, especially when we think about the rise of fascism today, which now he's going to talk about, I think, avoiding that central problem of, like, just collapsing into the mainstream status quo as a way to supposedly fight against fascism. Well, this history should show us what a problem that strategy is and how we have to do everything, basically, to avoid being, you know, trapped within the status quo that, you know, gives rise to such despicable, authoritarian, violent political trends such as fascism. So, yeah, I might leave it there.
Well, I want to talk about, obviously, the contemporary, I guess, kind of application of what Liam just went through. Over the last decades, I guess, we have seen the growth of a variety of fascist and far-right parties, organizations, and street movements across the world. So, you know, we think of, like, the election of Donald Trump in the U.S., the growth in the electoral strength and support for the far right in different European countries. So if we think of that, like Marine Le Pen in France, Viktor Orban in Hungary, and the FPO in Austria, to only name a few. And we've also seen as well the growth of violent far-right street movements. So, you know, Golden Dawn in Greece. We have also seen Tommy Robinson in the UK, the Proud Boys in the US, and as well the RSS in India. However, no capitalist crisis ever looks the same as another. We're not living through a revival of the 1930s. And I think that many on the left, I guess, have fallen into the trap of only tracing the similarities between the 1920s and 30s. However, I think, you know, when it comes to understanding fascism and, you know, I guess understanding this new political period we have entered, the question that we should be asking ourselves is not why our contemporary politics resembles those of the 1930s, but actually precisely why it does not. We have entered a new political period that is racked by crisis and the aftershocks of the 2008 global financial crisis. And I think also quite recently, you know, with the pandemic crisis on top of crisis. And the effects, I guess, of the COVID-19 pandemic that is truly ripping through, you know, a lot of countries in the global south, Europe, is absolutely creating economic cataclysms. And the effects, I think, of this, you know, crisis that we're seeing unfold will not be determined, you know, today or tomorrow, but in years to come is really when we will see the true effects of this crisis. And I think it's undeniably the biggest crisis, I think, since World War II. And this will undeniably shape the nature of politics and the scale of the far right in years to come. So, Liam just went through, I guess, the fascism of the classical period. And I wanted to look a little bit more at, like crisis today and be able to sketch out some of these key, I guess, theoretical points that he has made. So particularly the question of crisis, the question of fascism, you know, its base being the middle class and the element of reaction. And I think particularly going into, I guess, a political debate that is going on, which is when does fascism actually entrench itself as a state and when it does not, and whether or not we're seeing, I guess, some of that today. So, Trotsky, I guess, emphasizes crisis as a key and central ingredient in the emergence of fascism. He broke this down into three pillars, which is, you know, economic on the one hand, political and ideological. And when we apply this today, I think we kind of like can begin to piece some of the key defining moments of this. So firstly, the impact of the global financial crisis of 2008, which unleashed a tidal wave around the world that destabilized the traditional parties of the right and opened up a space for the populist far right to enter the scene with a lot of force. This created, I think, deep ruptures and polarized society further. On the one hand, traditional social democratic parties who ruled over this economic crisis lost all credibility, while simultaneously, you know, attempting to introduce harsh austerity measures onto the working class to try and stabilize the economy. So, you know, on the social democratic side, you can think of, like the Socialist Party of France in Spain, and then PASOK in Greece can be another example of that. This, I think, you know, also created opportunities for the left as well. And we see this embodied in political parties like Syriza, Podemos, and to a certain extent, the rise of Jeremy Corbyn could be kind of like allotted into there as well. But the central thing, I think, with the left or social democracy is that it was absolutely disorganized. The left was in shambles around the world and no gains were able to be won. And realistically, the far right and the right in society won the political battle of setting the agenda in society, shifting and, you know, kind of like really pulling society to the right. It is also worth noting that some traditional conservative parties also took massive blows during this period of crisis and, you know, instability. And we see this, you know, I guess kind of like captured by the ruptures in the Tories at the time in England and also the Republicans, you know, in the US. Secondly, when it comes to describing, I guess, the GFC is that Europe as well was going through its own, I guess, crisis that was accelerated by, Europe's own internal and external tensions. And this was very much driven by its own, you know, imperial kind of like outlook that it had at the time. And I think the kind of like biggest example of this is Brexit. As well to this, if you kind of like now jump to 2015, the other crisis that was rocking Europe is obviously the refugee crisis, which saw 2.2 million people, become refugees in 2015, people who were fleeing basically from North Africa and the Middle East. I think one of the most horrific examples that you can think of that is, Elan Kurdi, who was a three-year-old refugee who washed up in the shores of the Mediterranean Sea. His picture, I think, really resembles actually what this crisis, I think, represented for so many people. And lastly, I guess when Trotsky's talking about the ideological component of that, I think that we need to obviously address the question of the war on terror and Islamophobia. Because the war on terror, I think, continues to be instrumental in the fueling of the far right today. And I think that Islamophobia really marked the beginning of a new political period. Ruling classes around the world use this new ideological tool, weapon really, to impose aggressive anti-democratic measures domestically and strengthen their violent state apparatuses by increasing funding to the military and the police. And I think importantly, we see a pattern emerge where the majority, I guess, of far-right parties today use Islamophobia to win a base amongst the population. And similarly, fascist street movements have also stated the Muslim threat as a reason for their formation. So patriotic Europeans against the Islamization of the West, which is Pegida, which is based in Germany, is an example of this dynamic precisely. So I now want to look, I guess, at the current COVID-19 crisis, which is, again, still unfolding. But yeah, it's just, the biggest crisis that we're facing today. And the absolute collapse of the world economy, with millions of people dying, the mutation of the virus, I think, will mean that, until there is a vaccine, and even then, there's no promises that, the vaccine will basically solve any of the economic, crisis that we're seeing, because the vaccine is being rolled out differently in different countries. The virus is mutating, so the vaccine promises no stability for the capitalist class in any way. And I think what is certain about the, current economic crisis that we're facing is that it will deepen and it will continue to really shape politics over the next period. And we have also, I guess, started to see how the far right has been making gains out of the crisis that we're in today. So an example, I guess, of this is Viktor Orban, who has used the pandemic to cement his power in Hungary. So since the Fidesz's landslide victory in 2010, Orban and his party have worked very hard to push the government more to the far right. They have rewritten the country's constitution, removed checks on the power of the executive branch, and undermined the independence of the judiciary. Together with the Radical Nationalist Movement for a Better Hungary, or also known as Jobbik, Orban has played a, crucial role in shaping politics. And he has essentially portrayed, I guess, the traditional conservative parties as, kind of like sitting up high in the state while, the real citizens of Hungary face, basically harsh austerity, as well as, suffering from globalization and constant threats of immigrant invasion. Basically a bunch of, bullshit. But also during the pandemic, Orban was able to extend his already authoritarian powers. So a few things that he did was introduce a bill to prolong the state of emergency the government had declared in light of the pandemic. And the government is currently ruling by decree. And there is no sunset clause in the text for this state of emergency to end. So it's essentially been extended until whenever Orbán so desires it will end. There are no elections or rallies that can be had. There's also no changes to the criminal code, which, you know, actually interferes. Well, they've changed, sorry, the criminal code, and this immediately interferes with the protection of journalism and, you know, the ability for journalists to be, kind of like writing whatever they want. And they're actually basically been threatened with jail time if they're writing anything that the government doesn't want. So clearly kind of like an extension and, you know, a beefing up of the authoritarian state in Hungary. Another example, I guess, of the pandemic and this crisis really giving the far right some ammunition is really in the United States, where we have seen, you know, the convergence, I guess, of, you know, white supremacist organizations organizing with like anti-lockdown people and anti-mask demonstrators. And I think that this is, in a way, a quite interesting mix. I think it's a bit of a weird one. But the reality, I guess, of the base, if we're talking about, you know, the component, I guess, of the middle class that Trotsky described, is that the middle class through this pandemic in the US has been squeezed. They are essentially, you know, losing a lot of their wealth, and they have become the base for a lot of the far right, you know, I guess, protesting and organizing that is happening there. So we can see the element of the middle class expressed in these protests. I think as well, though, when it comes to the element of reaction, I guess, and the anti-worker sentiment, is that these, I guess, movements have been targeting healthcare workers. You know, there's, I think everyone here has seen videos of, you know, frontline workers or, you know, workers in shops basically being harassed by people who don't want to, you know, pop their masks on and stuff like that. And I just want to read out a quote, which I think Juan Del Mazo, you know, he put it really well in the sense of what to make up of these kind of like forces on the ground. And he said, in fact, the pandemic provided the momentum for the convergence and mobilization of once divergent tendencies into a new one, a more powerful and more reactionary force. The right wing of evangelical Christianity, anti-climate change and anti-vaccination movements, traditional and emergent racist organizations, anti-government militias, and QAnon. So that is kind of like all of that quite neatly packaged there. Another pattern, I guess, that we can identify as a defining feature of the far right today is the convergence of far-right political parties and mainstream politics into particularly the turn towards electoral work. And one element of Liam's talk about the classical fascist movements was the question of the relationship between the mainstream and the far-right. And just, you know, I think that this can be a controversial question. It was the case in the 1930s. But I think that Marxists should be drawing the connections there. And because precisely it is vital that we understand that fascists and the far right are not an aberration of traditional parties, but exist in symbiotic relation to them. And they feed off each other and essentially are, you know, right there together. So, in countries where the far right has made major headways electorally, we have also seen a defeated left that has been unable to capture that space and provide a left-wing alternative that can, you know, on the one hand, explain the crisis and make a political argument for the way forward for the working class. You know, this has also come on the back of, I guess, trade unions being defeated around the world, low density of trade unionism, with the exceptions, I think, of France in that case. But in general, kind of like the tendency has been a low class struggle in a lot of these countries. So I think some of these examples of the convergence of the far right with political parties, you know, I think we have to look at France. And in France, I guess mainstream political parties have attempted to dismiss the Front National, or the National Rally, as they like to call themselves and rebranded themselves as. And yeah, these traditional mainstream parties basically have branded, I guess, the Front National as extremists, but while also simultaneously, I guess, taking up some of their key policies as a way of attempting to remain in power. And both Republican and socialist governments have insisted on banning, you know, the veil. Macron, through a game of supposedly retaining freedom of speech, insists on schools in France showing racist cartoons about Muslims, and has continued France's most important battle against radical Islam. In 2017, the Front National won 11 million votes. And, you know, even then, you know, Marine Le Pen did not win the presidential race. However, I think the true victory of these, you know, 11 million votes was that they were able to really, you know, pull politics further to the right. And that, you know, was essentially the victory then. The history of the party is one of constant reinvention and repackaging. And British socialist Judith Orr described the Front National under Le Pen as distant to its previous Nazi collaborators and Algerian war veterans, demonstrating a plasticity, however not breaking from its base. The party has a loyal voting base. And I think that we can see this, you know, loyalty and support in, you know, particularly two elections. The first one, which was, you know, one of the highest votes that the Front National has ever gotten, which was in 2002. And this vote was so big, specifically because this came off the back of the war in Iraq, and really, you know, came off the back of Islamophobia really being cemented as a, you know, weapon in the arsenal of the ruling class. And then, of course, the 11 million votes of Marine Le Pen in 2017. And I think that you have to say that kind of like the goal of political parties like Le Pen is to make fascism more socially acceptable. As well, I think another example, I guess, of this is Alternative for Deutschland in, you know, Germany. And I think that nothing encapsulates, I guess, kind of like their politics and the 2018 programs that happened in Chemnitz, where, you know, word came out that two asylum seekers were suspected of like killing a German citizen. Turned out the guy was actually, you know, a Cuban, you know, migrant, but that didn't matter. You know, the nationalism that, you know, had been building, you know, in that country just meant that for, you know, like days, there were just like pogroms on the streets. And yeah, there's like horrendous videos, I think, of that event. And I think that this new far right in Germany is now coalescing into a coherent entity with well-defined contours and divisions of labor between the different components. So you have the AfD as a parliamentary wing and the militant extra-parliamentary wing in the form of Pegida, which I mentioned before. And the AfD became the first far-right party to enter parliament in Germany since World War II. They were formed in 2013 and claimed its main thrust was its opposition to bailouts of indebted European Union members. However, quite quickly, it became essentially the lifeline of Pegida to German parliament. The AfD, they are the third largest party in the lower house of federal parliament in the Bundestag. And in 2017, it captured 13% of the vote. And yeah, like the AfD wants to, again, you know, seal the EU borders, institute rigorous identity checks along, you know, Germany's national borders, and set up holding camps abroad to prevent migrants from leaving Germany. So yeah, like, again, you can see, you know, how the crisis has really been, you know, I guess, to the favor of political parties like that. So I guess kind of like moving across the globe to the US, because that is another, you know, archetypal example of the convergence of the far right and the mainstream today. And, you know, Donald Trump is kind of like, enough said, he represents that. And the last 4 years, I guess, have been marked by an emboldened far right that has, you know, a violent street movement attached to it. So you think of like Proud Boys, that kind of thing. And of course, you know, the vocal staunch supporter of this Trump in the White House. And, you know, just kind of like to, you know, remember some of Trump's, you know, first moves. You know, he immediately, I guess, appointed Steve Bannon as his administration chief strategist. So he's, you know, was the editor of Breitbart News, you know, far-right magazine. You know, he put a travel ban on 7 Muslim majority countries. And he was, of course, central to providing the landscape for the Unite the Right rally in 2017, which, of course, quite famously killed anti-fascist and anti-racist activist Heather Heyer. And of course, you know, this happened in Charlottesville. And, you know, when Trump was asked to condemn it, obviously he didn't, quoting, you know, that there was, you know, good people on both sides. And of course, this kind of, you know, emboldenment of the far right has not been stopped. You know, we saw how he completely punished Black Lives Matter activists by, you know, bringing in the National Guard to squash the movement last year. And he also, of course, mobilized his fascist base amongst that. And you could see, you know, some of his supporters coming to these demonstrations armed with weapons and all of that. And recently, in his incitement of storming of Capitol Hill in January, and this was, of course, you know, his last attempt to hold on to power, which we have to say went like really fucking poorly. So just like a few things to get straight about this, you know, thing, which, you know, it wasn't a coup. I think it was a right-wing protest. And I think what this attempt showed was firstly that Trump, you know, has solidified his base enough to bring a few thousand, you know, middle-class people to support his claim, you know, his electoral victory was stolen. So on the one hand, you know, it does show a little bit of strength of this base that he has been able to cohere throughout the years. But I also, you know, considering he is, you know, basically was president, has, you know, all of the tools available to him to cohere this mass movement, you have to say that, you know, that went pretty badly. As well, kind of like the myth of, you know, the white working class of America supporting Donald Trump all the way, all the time, was clearly not the case. When you see the composition of, I guess, the, you know, fire festival of coups, as Amir Rahmer said, you know, the composition of the people who mobilized were, you know, small business owners, off-duty cops, and upper management. So yeah, like I think when it comes to understanding that, you know, when you think of like the position that Trump occupied, his access to, I guess, the military and, you know, his fascist mobs, you know, to really undermine American democracy, like you're going to need a lot more than just this kind of like right wing, I guess, mobilization. And like, I just want to say two things about what this means, however, because a lot of the left, I guess, in the US fell into the trap of saying that this, you know, that fascism was impending, you know, in the US, that we were about to see fascism become entrenched. And this alarmist tone, I guess, you know, really disoriented the left, obviously, because what, you know, I guess political parties like the DSA did immediately was to say, well, actually, we need a campaign for Joe Biden. This is the most important political, you know, task that the left has, is we have to essentially build a popular front against fascism, which is kind of what they were arguing, actually, even though they called it, you know, a united front against that. So I guess my point there is that, you know, how we understand fascism matters, especially in what kind of political practice we have today, because this means that, you know, the left then prioritizes certain political movements over others. If, you know, this is the case, if fascism were truly about to kind of like be entrenched, then that means that, you know, your tactics and your strategies are X. However, if it's not, you know, then the question of Black Lives Matter and mobilizing for that becomes, you know, more important. And, you know, that's the direction that it should have, I guess, gone. So yeah, pandering to the argument that fascism, you know, was about to get rid of American democracy, absolutely disorganized and weakened the left. So I guess I want to quickly turn to India, because this, I think, kind of like encapsulates the debate of whether or not there is a fascist state, you know, that you know, has emerged or whatever. Because it is, I guess, a more advanced fascist political party and figure. You know, in many ways, Modi's India could easily fool a lot of people into thinking a fascist state is currently operating. And, you know, it does check, I guess, some of the boxes of classical fascism. You know, it has a reactionary street movement in the RSS. It has an authoritarian state. And, you know, it uses its, you know, fascist cater to discipline working class people. We've seen, you know, the RSS, you know, putting down student movements. We've seen it also attacking the farmers movement. However, I would argue that India is not a fascist state. I think that, you know, the RSS, if we're going to kind of like decompose it a little bit, is, the RSS is fascist. It is the longest running continuously cohered fascist group. You know, it was inspired by Mussolini and Italian fascism. The RSS consolidated in the 1920s. They cohere a whole section of networks and institutions like, you know, schools, hospitals, chakras, like they've infiltrated the armed forces, you know, the police, and, you know, are also part of different bureaucracies in India. However, I think that this composition, there's a few qualifications that means that it's not, I guess, fascist. And I guess the other thing as well is that the BJP, which is, this electoral vehicle, I guess, for the aims and desires of the RSS, is quite advanced and is, I guess, you know, using a lot of the ideas around Hindutva ideology, which is just Hindu nationalism, essentially, and is kind of like trying to push those political ideas and cohering it. So it has, you know, the mouthpiece of Modi in there. So it has like those, you know, the element of reaction there as well. The RSS, you know, it's very middle class. So it kind of like is, you know, ticking all of these boxes. But I guess I think to understand why it isn't, I think that we need to make two distinctions here. And the first one is, what is the difference between the sorts of politics in crisis that can lead to a fascist state entrenching itself as a last resort of capitalism to regain hegemony in a crisis that can lead to the opening up of space for the far right and fascist movements to develop. And we have to say that all of this is riddled by contradictions, polarization, and instability. And I guess just to wrap up, because I've kind of run out of time, is that I guess to conclude is that when fascism does actually entrench itself, it's not purely from crisis alone. Actually, the defining feature is class struggle. So is, you know, the working class, are they organized in a coherent way, in a way that is powerful enough to essentially shake the ruling class and create a crisis where fascism is actually more favorable for them to hold on to power? That's, you know, for that to happen, you're talking essentially about a revolutionary situation. And I think just to kind of like go back to the question that Liam raised, I guess, by the fact that in the 20s and 30s, you saw actually fascism in a lot of different European countries, but you didn't see fascist states in all of these European countries just because of the crisis of World War II. So again, crisis alone is not the only thing that can do that. Fascist movement alone is not the only thing that can achieve that. And, you know, a political individual, you know, that occupies a seat in the state cannot do that. So the key thing there is, class struggle and whether or not that threatens the capitalist class. So I guess, yeah, just to conclude, no, we're not seeing kind of like a fascist state emerging. However, the crisis and the contradictions that we're seeing today is extremely favorable for that to happen. And we also cannot go the other direction and say that it can never happen here, because the crisis today and the authoritarianism is obviously quite fertile for the far right to grow and for fascism as well.